Well, here we are at 98.7 RPP, and we have a great show today with Felix Tiang, who's going to be chatting to us about his music career. But I have to say, I've got a different co-host today. He's got a very deep voice compared to Simone.
He does have a deep voice.
Welcome, Jeff Nyson.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, Simone is offered a retreat somewhere.
Look, I have to apologise straight up. I'm nowhere near as nice or as jovial as Simone, but I'll do my best.
Do you think Simone's feeling jovial at the moment?
I think she's having a fantastic time.
Yeah.
I saw on Facebook, she put up a photo of just a room full of gorgeous fresh fruit vegetables. So she's in for an awesome time.
She is days of veganism and climbing up and down sand dunes to get fit. So a wonderful retreat that she's on. But anyway, so now, Jeff, you had a great weekend, didn't you?
I do. I've got the husky voice to prove it. My Tigers got up, didn't they?
Oh.
Am I taking the tone of the conversation down by talking about football this early in the morning?
I get the energy of the space. Like, I saw photos of you and a little short video, and it was just like, I've never seen you so happy.
I just can't explain.
Like, ridiculous.
Well, the beautiful thing about this is that the anticipation wasn't there for me. I never anticipated that the Tigers would get up. I was hopeful, but just out of the blue, bang, they won. And
won it easily.
It was halfway through the third quarter. I turned to some random person sitting next to me, lovely guy, as it turned out, and I said, I think we might win this. And it evolved from there. The train went on and we got up. It was just the most amazing moment.
Mm.
Not as good as having two kids. Not quite as good as getting married, but close.
Lucky you said that.
Well, that's it. I've got to recognise my family first.
Well, hey, now, Felix, let's do a quick intro of his amazing background.
Amazing Felix Tiang. Well, look, Felix, I've just met Felix today, and what an amazing guy. Felix is a seven-string guitarist, a music educator, and a musical director based in Melbourne. Look, we're going to hear so much about Felix today and his amazing story around music and his life. I can't wait. But before we do, we're going to jump straight to a song. The song is The Nearness of You, written by Felix. So,
oh, no, not written by me. Sorry. Good morning, guys, by the way.
Good morning, Felix.
We would like to think you wrote it.
I take credit for things I didn't do. But.
Not going to get away with this one, though. Nearness of You is written by the great Hoagy Carmichael, the same composer who wrote Georgia on My Mind, Stardust, you might know. I chose this song specifically. I'm playing it today because I teach guitar as well. I teach jazz guitar quite a bit. And with a number of my students, I often take the exercise of a song like Misty and play that as a template for them to study. The Nearness of You happens to have the same chord progression. And I thought, for a change today, I'll play something, have it recorded, that my students can use as a separate template for Misty. So here it is, The Nearness of You.
The Nearness of You. What a gorgeous song.
How beautiful was that?
That's amazing.
Thank you, guys.
I'm so relaxed.
I should mention that was played on a seven-string guitar. You mentioned that was a seven-string guitarist before. I've got a low A string on my guitar. So I have the normal six strings of a guitar. And then I have a seventh string, which is the same pitch as the bass guitar's A string. So it's actually quite low. It gives me a nice bass range. So hopefully you heard a little bit of that as I was playing The Nearness of You. But that's the sort of thing, that's essentially me. That's the guitar is built by Gary Rizzolo, who's a luthier, Melbourne luthier now. He used to be in Tasmania. Built some gorgeous guitars here. It's an arch top seven string guitar, custom made for me.
Yeah. Wow.
Awesome instrument.
Yeah.
And
that's one for the wall.
Thank you.
So let's get into your story, Felix. So now you were born in Malaysia, is that right?
I was. And I came here at a fairly young age, for year 11. So born and raised in Malaysia, sent over here to study at age of 14, and I came in at year 11, so quite a couple of years younger than my peers. I had, being from an Asian family, I'm Chinese Malaysian. I had fairly liberal Chinese parents. So by liberal, I meant my father was an Elvis fan who permed his hair every day for you.
Oh, hilarious.
My mom was a Carpenters fan, right? So not traditional Chinese parents, so not your dragon parents, but they were very open to me wanting to do whatever I wanted to. As long as sort of fit within the mold at the end of the day. So I came here when I was 14, went through Yale in year 12, got into uni at the age of 16.
Unbelievable.
Now, and that's
so, because that's a couple of years,
a couple of years ahead. Yeah. And here's the issue though. While I was capable of doing the work required to get through Yale in year 12 and in university at that age, I wasn't emotionally ready for the experience. Mm-hmm. I think I was a slow kid. By comparison, you know, every child's different. The way you and the way you develop is different. I think I was particularly slow,
right,
and not ready for experience. So socially, I was very isolated.
Mm. See, in kinesiology world, we call that EQ. IQ.
Yeah,
so you can
right.
have
that's...
very high IQ,
yeah.
But you know, sometimes kids can just be so good at academia, but then the emotional structure of things and the social structure of things is a little bit more sort of challenging.
Yeah, the concept of emotional intelligence. I remember the book from the 80s.
There you go.
Yes, so I got through my university years. Actually, I got into university not knowing... and not having any real concept about what the real world was like. I became an accountant. I studied accounting largely because I had no idea what else to do. I had no concept of what an accountant actually really did, despite the illusion of being of understanding what was happening
around. I think that's quite common. I know when I was going through high school, you hit year 11 and year 12, and they say, okay, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? Make a decision.
Yeah, exactly. You're making a decision at a point in life where you have got no context, right?
But I was 17. I had another couple of years of experience and nurturing and mentoring from my family. Yeah. Just a question. Did you have family over here? Or?
I did, actually. Actually, we had a lot of family members down in Melbourne. A lot of them in academia, but I stayed with my auntie and uncle when we came up. So we had good family system, structure, and support here. So that wasn't the issue.
That's important, isn't it?
It was. It made a huge difference to myself and my younger sister came over at the same time, much younger than I did. It made a huge difference to us just fitting in and settling down. But coming back to your point, that's very true. We're asked at a very young age, before we're even really aware of what's happening around the world, to pick something that we do for the rest of our lives. And the reality is, I think what you're probably starting to see is a lot of people, or you probably have seen this for quite a while, a lot of people starting to change careers through your 30s and 40s. You know, what you pick isn't necessarily what you end up doing for the rest of your life. Much like me, so I became an accountant, and I'm now playing music. So I got out, worked as an accountant for a little bit. I then went on to do various things, and I've spent most of my business career in technology commercialization and startups. Highly risky area to work in.
Yeah, for sure.
The initial premise, I suppose, and this was partially supported by my family as well and investments locally, but the idea was that Australia is a very, it's a well-developed country. We've got great infrastructure. We've got great technology coming out of universities here. Why is it all going overseas? Can we not try to make a go at commercializing good technology locally? Mm-hmm. That was, how many years ago was that now? 15, 16 years ago? Went down the path of investing in a number of technologies. Took one of them to the ASX. We listed the company. It was good technology, solid technology out of Melbourne University, the physics department of Melbourne University. And then we discovered how difficult it really was to get anything off the ground in Australia. The reality was you're so isolated from the rest of the world geographically.
We are so far away, aren't we? We'd like to think we're close, but the reality is that we are far away. Both by time and distance.
And the tyranny of time and distance is everything when it comes to trying to commercialize technology internationally. Because the reality is, Australia, as good as our infrastructure is, we don't really have high-end manufacturing in Australia. I mean, what do we have here? We've got cars.
Yep.
You know, you're talking about groundbreaking technology in physics. No one in Australia can use it.
No,
because there's just no industries that can use it. So our customers were European or American, and and that was basically it. So we had to travel to Europe and the States to try to explain new technology nobody had ever seen before.
Yep.
To people who didn't know they wanted it. Mm. You know, you'd go there for a whirlwind tour for 1 month. Everyone gets excited over there about your new tech. You come back 6 months later, nothing's happened. You wonder why, and they just
they've forgotten about you.
Well, they hit a roadblock, okay. And they didn't realize how to fix it, and they couldn't just pick up a phone and have you come over and fix it. So, so we struggled with that for a while, and then on top of that, there were a whole lot of issues in that. As much as trying to be careful not to get into politics here, as much as we like to think that. The government, the local government here, both sides of the aisle, highly supportive of technology. The reality is we're not really doing anywhere near enough to give any Australian tech companies a competitive edge at all. I mean, we're nowhere in the ballpark.
Do you think that's changing, or do you think that, like, is it different to 15 years ago, or is it?
I think it's gotten worse in some respects.
Oh, okay.
The challenges we have here on the, so apart from the supply side in terms of, customers for the technology, which is one issue, the other aspect of what you need to incubate technology successfully is the investment, the supply side, everything that supports that organization getting up off the ground. Tech companies are generally equity rich, cash poor.
Yeah, sure.
We've got a very small investment market here to begin with, and fairly unsophisticated investors because of the size of the small size of the investment market. So raising money is very, very difficult.
And one of the challenges, and we see it in pharmaceuticals as well, we don't have that old money.
No.
With the philanthropists that are looking to really give a kickstart to new up and coming new start businesses, the old money is just not there. It's all new money, and people with new money are a lot more careful with their money than people with old money.
But there's also a lack of understanding with investors. Again, it's not the fault of the investment community. It is what it is. It's that given the size of the investment community, there's just not a large enough pool of people who understand how to invest in technology, understand the risks involved. Everyone's looking to make a quick buck.
Right.
At the end of the day, there was a classic case in around 2007. I think it was the 2007 May budget. The Labor government at the time, the Treasurer, had introduced policies to get rid of. This is getting technical in the technical accounting sense. To tax options for employees. Immediately on receipt, as opposed to when they convert into shares.
Sure.
Yeah, for those of you who understand what I'm talking about, the issue with that, again, as I said, is that technology companies are equity rich, cash poor. Mm. And a lot of us pay our employees in equity, in options or shares, in order to make ends meet for everyone. And in taxing them up front, effectively what you were saying to employees was that we haven't paid you this $10,000 in salary yet, we're giving it to you in shares, so you don't have the cash, but the government would like to tax you $3,000 or $4,000 of that. So,
right.
And
that's an interesting environment, isn't it?
Well, and I raise that because it's a classic example of what I mean by that just isn't the support or understanding locally, even at the government level. And this is a Labor government in supporting technology. They introduced that policy, and it literally wiped out our entire basis of remuneration, and not just for us, for a large number of tech companies, and that has that has never been fixed.
Can I, just reflecting on this, can I ask a question and bring it back to you? How does this find Felix? 12 years ago, because the stories about you and you living and working in that environment.
Yeah,
how did that impact you?
I suppose the thing is, coming out of university early, still not understanding what a tax return was. Get this. I studied to be an accountant. I worked as an accountant. And if any of my old bosses are listening, no, I didn't actually discover what a tax return was until at the end of the first year of me working for you.
I'm still not sure I know what one is. I know I hand the cash over.
I was very slow.
The switchboard's about to light up, that.
I'm sure I did all my work properly. No, but coming out not really understanding what was happening, I suppose I blundered my way through the various jobs I had. I wasn't really making any conscious decisions, I think, was the issue.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as I got into technology and then found myself not stuck in it, but you know, I was in it, not really knowing what else to do. And once you're in something, you just keep, you know, the momentum's there, you just keep going. I matured in that technology space. And that's when I started realizing things as I grew, got into my 30s. I think that was probably when I started waking up to things. By the time I was 30, in my 30s, the company was well listed. We had run into all these issues. I learned a lot about life in general. And that's where things started becoming real for me, I suppose. I mean, can you imagine actually waking up at the age of 30, realizing, oh my God, this is the job I'm in.
I haven't started yet. Yeah, I haven't started my life yet.
But 10 years have gone by and I've done a whole lot of this, a whole lot of this other stuff.
Do you know what I'm hearing from what you're saying is, you know, it's interesting that you said you obviously brilliant academically as a kid, which I feel that's very much your left brain. You know, that's that logical brain. That's 1 + 1 = 2. That's the accountant in you. But when you listen to your choices, it sounds very trailblazing all the way through, which is right brain. And that's also the lover of music in you as well. So it's interesting that that right brain has been niggling away at you. Do you know what I mean?
Slowly. Yeah,
wanting something new, wanting to create something, wanting to build something that's never been done before. Mm. And it's really interesting that, that it still crept through, even if it was business, even if it was accounting, it was still wanting to do it differently. Oh. And that's what I love about your story.
I was passionate about accounting. I was passionate about the technologies that I was supporting at the time. I enjoyed the work while I was in it, despite the difficulties. I suppose coming back to what to your question, Jeff, is that after as time went on, as I went through my mid-30s, I started realizing that there were issues with the general premise has always been that work in business, pick a profession, pick a safe career.
Yeah,
right,
sure.
Get into business because it's safe, and the implication of that is that music's not a real job. It's not a real profession.
It's not a real job.
Yeah, it's not safe.
Yeah, this is kinesiology.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of risk associated with being a musician, and I think what I've come to realize is that as long if you enjoy what you do and you understand the space you're in, the risks are no different.
No.
You know, if I wanted to be Michael Jackson or you know a 1 in a billion star. Yeah, sure, the risks are huge. As the chances of me ever making it up there are huge. But if I wanted to be Rupert Murdoch, same risks, same chances true. There.
And this is where the real oxymoron is. Like, we look at success and what success is in our lives. And often we judge success on the size of our house, size of our car, the amount of money we're making. But success isn't there. Success is where your heart is and what you love doing.
Absolutely.
So are you achieving what you love? And for many of us, and especially for myself, I had to have a jump start, you know, a diagnosis of cancer for me to realize that I needed to chase the real success, which is doing things I love as opposed to doing things that I was meant to do.
Yeah.
And it seems like you're in a similar spot.
Well,
right?
I think all of us are really, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah.
Satisfaction in life is the ultimate goal at the end of the day. If you're not happy with it, why? What are you doing?
Yeah, we're not here forever.
And so your goal was music.
Well, music has always stayed with me. That's the thing. So again, musical opportunities in growing up in Malaysia were very, very limited.
Sure.
But I was always drawn to it. So throughout my entire period working in technology, I had always was doing something musically on the side, but I was fortunate enough to be able to do it at a level where I was performing live. I was actually earning, making a sub living out of it as well. So I've always been playing at a reasonably high standard, and I count myself as fortunate for being able to do that despite having another primary focus being the business world.
Now you've created another composition for us. I'd love to listen to this one.
Yes, this is called For Django. I like puns. Django is my first child, my dog, little Maltese Shih Tzu. My wife Jennifer and I picked him up a year before we had kids. He was our training
the
practice child.
Yeah,
that's right.
How'd you go changing nappies though?
He was much easier.
Stop running away.
Much easier than babies. Much easier than babies. We love him dearly. Yeah. Django unfortunately is in the September of his life. He's quite old. He's 14 years. He's blind. He's got chronic liver problems. He's probably not going to be with us for very long. And it's a very sad time in our family's life. So I wrote this Fur Django.
Oh, beautiful.
As in F-U-R, because he's gorgeous. Furry, and Fur Django, for Django.
Oh, I love that.
And it's a jazz waltz. It comes in three, it has a motif that moves in three parts. And you'll hear the motif get sadder over the course of the piece. I should also mention, in case anyone isn't very familiar with jazz, what generally happens is that when we play a composition, we play the main melody. We then compose on the spot. We improvise over that structure. And that's where the fun comes in when we play jazz. And then we finish off often by repeating that motif again to remind you of where we came from.
Wow.
So this is for Django.
Here we go. It sounds like radio. RPP 98.7, you're on Your Story Counts, and we're chatting with Felix Thang. I'm sitting here with Jeff Nyson and myself, Nana Dabba. We're just chatting about compositions and accountants and really finding your thing.
Listening to some awesome music, Fur Django.
Thank you.
That's gorgeous.
Thank you. I always want to talk a bit about my musical background, where I've come from.
Yeah, I was just fascinated to hear about that. That although you've talked about the accountant in you and the business guy and the entrepreneur, really, but underneath that there was this rebel all the way through that just had this love affair with music.
Yeah. Well, my dirty secret is, and my students will get a laugh out of this, I was a very poor guitar student when I was growing up. So I picked up the guitar. Every Chinese child has to have the obligatory musical instrument they play. I sucked completely at the piano. I could not pick it up. So my parents gave...
Australians have the obligatory recorder to play.
Ah, there you go. Well, no, I had a recorder as well. That was already given. If it was in school, you had to do it. You had to do another one outside. But but my parents, being the liberal parents they were, and Dad loving Elvis, he allowed me to play the guitar. So I picked up the classical guitar when I was about 6 or 7 years old. But I was terrible at it. I just couldn't find a motivation to play it. My teacher would turn up and I would practice during the lesson, that sort of thing. You know, I complained about that with my students a lot. But the musical environment in Malaysia at the time, this is, you know, I was a child of the 70s and 80s, growing up in Malaysia in the 70s and 80s. It was a very different world. It's still cosmopolitan now, and the world's a much smaller place now. But back then, you know, we had to go down to a local shop in a nook, which was a nook in a wall or a tent set up somewhere that sold cassettes. And what you listen to just depended on what they had in stock. And this little shop that I went to that sold cassettes had a very limited selection. But one day I was just browsing around because, you know, once you get through everything you want to listen to, what else do you listen to? I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I picked up this Muddy Waters cassette. Muddy Waters is a great blues legend. A lot of people refer to him as the father of the electric blues. I had no idea who he was. Listened to the album and did not like it at all, but I knew I should be liking it.
Yeah, right. Why didn't you like it?
It was strange. I mean, I had grown up listening to Elvis Presley, The Carpenters, and my exposure to modern music in the 80s was the Grammy Awards. You know, Billie Jean was Beat It. It was big at that time.
Yeah, right.
And the blues was very raw. It was unlike anything I heard of, and it sounds silly for people in the West to sort of hear that, because you're surrounded by a large range of music. You don't realize how spoilt you guys are. But this was the strangest sound I ever heard. It was the most awful sound I ever heard at the time. But I felt I needed to listen to it. I don't know why. And back then we would play a lot of music in the car as a family, and it drove my parents nuts. But I persisted. It wasn't until I got to university that I started understanding what these were, because you had friends who showed me how to improvise. And I started getting into it, and that led me down the path of 8-hour a day practice sessions in quotation marks, banging around a guitar, studying in university, and trying to figure my way around it. It wasn't until I, during my university years, I walked down to, was it Allen's at the time? I think it was an Allen's store. Allen's is still Allen's around. They're still around in a small way. But they used to sell CDs a lot as well, apart from instruments, right? Mm-hmm. And I picked up a $2.99 in the bargain bin CD. It had Round Midnight on the cover. And there was one track on it, which was Round Midnight, with a 4-bar intro by a guitarist. I think it was Jim Hall. And this is the crazy thing. That 4-bar introduction with just a solo guitar,
yep.
got me hooked on jazz guitar. I had to figure out what this jazz thing was. Yeah, and on jazz guitar, it sounded beautiful. And to this day, I still have no idea who that, what that how song was and who that recording was by, because it was in a bargain bin and I didn't pay any attention to it. So I'm still trying to figure it out. I search for Around Midnight everywhere I can on the internet and try to just hear this whole box.
Your inspiration's lost.
I know. How sad is that? Anyway.
Well, so if anyone knows,
connect
him with us.
Yeah. My life's mission is to figure out what that tune was. I was very fortunate to fall into lessons with the great Bruce Clark, who earned an Order of Australia for his contribution to Australian music. He was a great jazz guitar legend in Australia. And I say fall into it, a lot of people search him out deliberately to get lessons from Bruce Clark. I literally looked up the Yellow Pages, walked into his studio and said, "Would you teach me?" He gave me an audition and taught me, and I had no idea who he was.
It sounds like it was meant to happen. Isn't it funny how the world just brings us and connects us to the place that we're meant to be? It almost paves a way for us.
So Bruce was probably my biggest influence in disciplining me to study music properly. I was classically trained. I could read a bit, but Bruce showed me what it meant to actually be musically literate, to actually speak the language of music properly. He set me on the right path. I wasn't with him very long though. That's probably my one biggest regret in life. From a musical perspective, I in my early 20s, I was involved in a very bad motorcycle accident that basically stopped my playing cold. I lost the use of my right arm. I severed the bone in my right arm, the humerus, damaged all nerves around it. I could hardly move my right hand, certainly not enough to play. I called Bruce up and said, told him what had happened, and I'd had to stop lessons. And he said to me, "I'm sorry to hear that, but you know, if there's anything, there's one thing you can do as you get better, just play chords."
Yeah.
And that was the advice he left me with.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple. And I did. So it took 3 years to recover from that. I never went back to him for lessons. I'm not sure why. But as I recovered, that's what I did. I just played chords. And the most magical thing happened in simplifying everything down and not being able to do any complicated stuff or any flashy stuff. I had to focus. And as it turned out, chords was the right thing to focus on because it gave me an understanding for the structure behind a lot of these compositions. I started seeing patterns evolve. And as a result, I started understanding, appreciating music much better. And that led me down to developing my jazz guitar workshop methodology. So what I discovered for myself was a very organic and progressive way to understand the language of jazz. It is a dialect and musical language at the end of the day. And I've thankfully, I think, been successful in being able to transfer that knowledge or transfer that understanding of the language to my students as well.
Does that mean that you would be able to teach me jazz?
I think I certainly should be able to give you an appreciation for the language, and that's the beauty in it.
Right? I think you just said no.
That was a no. Did you hear that?
That was a no. That was definitely yes.
Some people.
Jeff, maybe, but you, no.
Bridge too
no.
Far. Sorry.
I'm
just gonna have to just listen to it.
Yeah. Well, like every other language, there's not a lot to understand about jazz other than that there's a tradition in the dialect that where performers like to riff over and just chat like we are now over a topic. So a jazz piece is nothing more than a topic we've picked. Everyone understands the topic because there's a very definite structure to it. Everyone then jumps in and just plays their own version of it, trying to fit in together. And then they allow somebody, the soloist, to really go to town with it while supporting him. And that's it at the end.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So what I find remarkable is that through the adversity of you breaking your arm and not being able to use your right hand, it was life-altering in a way. Really defined
exactly,
you into a direction.
That's the thing. It's like whenever I think back to that period of in my life, I could have, I suppose in a lot of ways, that could have stopped me from playing full stop. It could have changed my life in a very different way. For some reason, it ended up doing this. It ended up in me developing a stronger passion for music, not not less of a passion.
It brought the love out, didn't it?
Yeah, and is that an indication that I was meant to do this? I don't know. Is there anything, if that didn't stop me from pursuing a career in music or playing music, what's going to stop me? And I suppose that's part of the realization I hope I've come to, in that I don't think I could stop myself from playing music. Even if I were successful, and even if my business had been successful, and it had gone somewhere, I think I'd still be doing this to a certain extent, because I don't think I could stop myself. What sadly happened, though, was in 2008 with a global financial crisis that wiped out all our contracts, and I found myself back at square one. Mm-hmm. I tried to do a number of other startups because I couldn't help myself. I developed a computer game. I did all
how
the artwork.
Cool is that? We're going to have to check that out. What computer game is it?
Keebles. No, it's a game. It's a concept that my friend and I came up with. It's a physics puzzler. So if anyone's interested, it's on Steam. It's called Keebles, K-E-E-B-L-E-S. Go buy it, please. It's very cheap. It's a great game. It's
very cheap. It's very probably cheap. $2. Yeah, it like that cassette.
If you wait for a sale, it'll be $2. But I mentioned a game as one of the things I did because I was very proud of it. It was a big chunk of my life at the time, and I still enjoy it.
Is there anything
playing.
You haven't done?
I haven't done
it. I know, it's just like...
And the other thing I did with this same friend was if you use a music electronic instrument tuner or metronome on the Windows platform as opposed to the Mac, on the Windows desktop or on the App Store, we're probably the number one metronome and tuner on the Windows Store. Yes, so it's still there.
That's helpful.
When if you want it on the desktop.
Not for you because
I'm never going to learn anyway, so I just need to listen.
So I think I've given everything else a fair go. And I've come to the realization that at the end of the day, everything I do is going to be difficult if I'm trying to get to a certain level. Yep. And if it's all going to have the similar risks and it's all going to be difficult, why am I not just doing what I enjoy?
That's very valid point. Now, there's another composition here that you've made.
No, this is not my composition.
Okay.
This is Manhattan Carnival, written by Luis Bonfa. It's a bossa nova, played originally famous for being in the movie Black Orpheus, Portuguese film. This is performed by my trio. The Felix Tiang Trio, with Daniel Binky on double bass and Jeremy Lee on drums. I'm very fortunate to have much better musicians than me supporting my playing. So here we go.
98.7 RPP. You're listening to Your Story Counts, and I'm sitting here with Felix Thang and Jeff Nyson.
Not Simone.
And not Simone.
She's still eating nice food, having a good time.
800 calories is all she's getting
800.
A day.
Oh, I think we're having more fun than that.
I know. I said to her,
hot chocolate after this.
I said to her, I can't wait to have the first coffee with you. After a week of no coffee.
She's not. You can't let her drive home after that coffee.
No, that's right.
You have to drive her.
She'll be like, woo. Yeah. So anyway, it'd be good fun. Felix, we've been, chatting about your life, and that is one that, you were born in Malaysia in 74 and obviously found yourself in Australia and highly academic. Oh my God, he was already out in uni at 16.
That's
We wouldn't even know who we are. No. I wouldn't even know how to pack my lunch by then.
I don't think I did either.
You want to play basketball? Yeah, that's right. We're out surfing and windsurfing. And anyway.
Not the serious stuff.
But has had this incredible brain that can integrate, and that's what I'm fascinated by. He's a chartered accountant, but also a very talented musician. And he's taking the world by storm at the moment. He's out there. He's got his own YouTube. He's got his own following. He's also teaching and a unique methodology for jazz that most people can get, but me. very talented. Oh, and he's also got a game, wasn't it? Yeah. It was a physics-based.
A vehicle puzzler.
A puzzler.
I probably should take some lessons in marketing. That's a very long description.
Wow. It is, isn't it? The new generation would make that three letters or something. But, now let's hear a little bit more. So you're now at the stage where you've decided music is your thing and you've really ventured out.
I'm making a go of it. And in the process, trying not to ruin my family or children.
Your beautiful two daughters,
my two daughters. I've got Alyssa, who's 13, and Zoe, who's 11, with my beautiful wife, Jennifer, who's, I've got to say, Jennifer's been the best support I could have ever asked for. She hasn't complained once throughout this entire transition. Can you imagine?
They really are up at Hobbs, aren't they?
Well, the transition I'm making, or transitions I've made, plural, have been quite significant and scary. Mm.
Yep.
We haven't ever had a single fight over it. We haven't had, I don't think anything's, thank you, Jennifer. Love you.
Do you have those conversations at 2 o'clock in the morning and she goes, okay, this is where we're heading now.
You want to do what?
Maybe you should get her on this program and
see. Yeah, that's right.
And find out for me. She probably won't tell me.
There'd be a story in that for sure.
Probably. But yes, no, I'm teaching music actively, obviously. I teach in a local primary school, Auburn South Primary, where my children, one of my children still goes to. In teaching music, I'm teaching my jazz methodology, as I mentioned, that I developed. I'm hoping, what I really hoped with that was to try to find, introduce the language of jazz to a larger number of guitarists. And one of the things I've always lamented has been the lack of musical literacy in guitarists in particular. Like people make jokes about drummers. The reality is most drummers can read a drum chart because they have to as they learn. Whereas guitarists, what's the classic joke? How do you make a guitarist play softer? Put music in front of him. and there's no reason.
I like that. Yeah, I actually get that.
and it
that's why I don't use music.
Yeah. and it really shouldn't be like that. So with a lot of my younger students, I've put together my own progressive syllabus to take them through a literacy program as well as a performance-based focus program to take them right through to entrance additions into university program they like. I mean, the idea again being that you can appreciate a language much better if you can read and write it. You know, we would never make the argument with the English language, for example. You can learn any language, music or spoken language, orally. You can get by ordering food and living in a community without having to read or write. But you would never make the argument that it would be better not to read and write. And just have an oral command of the language, and yet I hear that about from a lot of other musicians. You know, reading and writing music stifles my creativity, and that infuriates me. That could not be further from truth. How can being more literate in a language take anything away from you? Logically. Being able to understand something better, being able to communicate something better, should add to your experience to music.
Here's the challenge with it. I've just started learning piano in the last couple of weeks. And I've picked up piano throughout my life. Like, my mum was a beautiful pianist, and I went to sleep with her playing. And so I always had a fascination.
For sure.
And not to mention the fact that, you know, there's untold benefit in learning how to play an instrument. But with that does come learning how to read sheet music and write sheet music and what have you. It's hard.
No, it is. I mean,
it's monotonous too. Yeah. To be entirely honest, it can be monotonous. Yeah. But that monotony is okay if you enjoy what you're doing.
And once you get past chopsticks, well, you're going to enjoy so much more.
Chopsticks is good.
My, I know, it's a good start. It's a good.
To put things in context, though, I'm pragmatic at the end of the day. Every language is an orally based language, and writing and learning to be literate in it is optional in certain respects. It depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
If French or Italian was your second or third language and you just wanted to learn enough to converse with a few people and that's all you wanted to do, that's fine. But that's not the same as being fully literate in language. With a lot of my adult students who don't have the time to learn literacy, to take time to be literate in it, and all they do want to do is just catch around with friends around a campfire and play and sing music, sure. Just learn to play music orally. That's what we do.
Well, Felix, you have been amazing today. Now, how do people get hold of you? You know, we can obviously, there's a YouTube channel. There's obviously seeing you live. There's getting lessons from you.
The best place to get a hold of information on me or get a hold of me full stop is to visit my website. It's www.tiang.com. Tiang spelled, unfortunately, T-H-I-A-N-G. So if you visit my website, there's links to my YouTube channel there. I plan to put some guitar lessons up there, but plan to put my entire guitar course up there at some point.
It's a work in progress. So we can learn by osmosis.
That's right. So I've got a Facebook page. Please follow me on that. I like to post updates on what I do. We've got Instagram. Mm. Everything's on the website, so you can go down and have a look at that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yep.
The last track that I've got for you to play, Jennamore. Again, I wrote this for my wife Jennifer. It's a play on words again. Amor in Portuguese is love. J apostrophe enamor. Enamor is to be enamored with. Yeah, and obviously gorgeous. Her name's Jen, so it's Jen enamor. Jennamore. Yep.
You're such a romantic. She's a lucky woman. Hey?
Tell you what.
So I wrote this.
I think it's payback. That's what it is. Yeah,
that's right. Negative, positive. I'll write you a song if you let me become a musician.
So this was actually played by a friend of mine, with a friend of mine in a guitar duo, Alejandro Flores, who's a flamenco guitarist. We're playing this Friday night at a Robert Burns Hotel in Collingwood. I wrote this song the next morning. He came around. Recorded it sight unseen, so he's asked me to make excuses for him. But come down and see us at Robert Burns on Friday night. Here's Jennamore.